Hello and good evening, everyone. I am Nidhi Baghel. Welcome to our SGR Knowledge Foundation's Knowledge Series. The session of Knowledge Series is organized every month. Irrespective of the pandemic and lockdown, the sessions of Knowledge Series will continue to encourage, motivate, and enhance the energy of the audience of Knowledge Series. Knowledge Series is a point of origin for the Central India's first multilingual literature festival, Orange City Literature Festival, OCLF Nagpur. OCLF is now entering into the fourth edition this November 2022, after the success of past three editions of it. Knowledge Series session is now a part of Orange City Literature Festival. Today, we have invited Sarika Kanwalkar for the session on diving deep into the wildlife trade. Sarika is a scientist and science impact practitioner and has published work in preview journals, produced content for popular media outlets, and been named a Fulbright Scholar and National Geographic Explorer. She obtained her BS in biology at Gonzaga University and is currently a PhD candidate at Columbia University while running the nonprofit Wild Tiger, which she founded in 2015. Sarika has done ecological research across the United States, Ecuador, the Turks and Caicos Island, Peru and India, and has worked with a range of endangered species, including frogs and sea turtles, and in diverse social contexts. Today, she has dedicated her work to conservation issues in Central India and tigers. She does research on forest health and forest livelihoods using a variety of methods, including household surveys and satellite imagery analysis. In addition, she examines the global trade in tiger parts with a particular focus on the United States, with the ultimate aim of reducing the poach of wild tigers. Welcome, ma'am. We welcome our moderator for the session, Advocate Mridula Vijayaraghavan. Advocate Mridula Vijayaraghavan specializes in wildlife and environmental law and has worked on some landmark cases. She was working with WCS till very recently and is now exploring options to study further. Welcome, ma'am, to the SGR Knowledge Series. I request Advocate Mridula Vijayaraghavan, ma'am, to kindly take over the session.
Thank you so much, Nidhi, for those introductions. And a very happy Wildlife Day. Which is why we've selected this topic. So thank you for having us. I wanted to start out, Sarika, by asking you about, you know, what inspired you to take on a career in conservation. Usually there's an exciting story or a sighting of a wild tiger. So I'm curious about what was your story.
Yeah, well, first off, thank you so much for having me. It's an honor to be invited here and speaking on a topic that is so close to my heart for World Wildlife Day. Well, I don't know if I have one specific crazy story, but what got me interested in conservation at the beginning was science, really. I always wanted to be a scientist, and actually I wanted to be like my parents who work in the medical field. So I wanted to be a doctor, probably like many of you at one point in your life. It was during my undergraduate, when I was getting my bachelor's in science and biology, that I had the chance to go on a study abroad to the Galapagos Islands. And if you know anything about science, you probably know Charles Darwin. And the Galapagos is where he was inspired to write his theory on evolution. So I really wanted to go there just as a scientist with this curiosity of what sort of inspired Darwin. When I went there, it was actually my first time being introduced to field ecology. And that is, you know, applying the scientific method to the outdoors and being in the natural world, but using, hypotheses and observations to answer questions. And I just couldn't believe that people actually got paid to do this work, to be outside, not in a lab, not behind a desk, but in these places with plants and animals that you could only dream of. So I just couldn't believe that people actually got paid for it. So that's really when I made the decision to sort of pivot my focus, and I started just learning more about wildlife specifically. And when it comes to conservation and wildlife in India, it was really after I got my undergraduate degree, I had a chance to come work in 2014 with the Nagpur-based NGO Tiger Research and Conservation Trust. And that's where I was introduced to the complexity, which is the central Indian landscape, where, you know, on one hand, we have tigers and this this flagship species of the landscape, which, you know, as a global priority, we do need to save, and we would like to see increases in population. But at the same time, in central India, you have a large population of people, largely indigenous, who have lived closely with the forest for so long. So what really got me interested in working in central India and on tiger conservation specifically is really the complexity in answering this question, which all of us are working towards, which is how are we going to sustain wild tiger populations, and at the same time, respect and value the human lives that are also in this landscape. It's a really complex question that we're all still trying to figure out. That's what ultimately got me hooked on conservation in India.
Thanks, Sarika. That sounds like an exciting journey over the years. Much of your work seems to also be focused on the illegal trade in wildlife and on tigers. And I'm curious about why you think it is important work, and why should we be worried about this trade?
I think in general, what I've learned about the illegal wildlife trade is that it is really these transnational criminal organizations who are profiting the most from exploiting our wildlife and resources. These are organizations that also traffic humans, drugs, and narcotics. And so injustices against people in the planet are just inextricably linked. When I say that, you know, I'm fighting against the illegal wildlife trade, it's also linked to, you know, human rights abuses and human trafficking and all these other injustices that we see. So I see them just all very linked together and sort of run by the same people. So that's sort of generally. And then for tigers, I see a lot of what is motivating the demand for tiger parts at this time is purely based off of like human greed. It's for social status. It's for, I want a picture with a tiger. I want to get a pet tiger so I can post this picture on social media and get likes and comments. That is simply the most greedy and selfish use of wildlife. So to me, it's just so sort of useless. I don't see the point as to why people are continuing to exploit wildlife in this way. So those are the sort of two things that that motivate me to work on the wildlife trade.
Thanks. That's fascinating. It also seems like the trade is only getting more and more pervasive and more nuanced. And I think we'd love to hear a little bit more about the research that you've been conducting on trade in tigers, particularly in the States. Would you like to walk us through some of it?
Yeah, absolutely. I'm going to take a little bit. I don't want to bore everybody too much with the monologue, but I'm going to take a little bit to walk everyone through some of this recent research that I just published just at the beginning of this year in the journal Conservation Science and Practice, along with my co-authors, Monique Sosnowski and Sharon Gynep. So here actually are photos of tiger parts that were seized in the United States by law enforcement. And when I say that these parts were seized, it means that they were detected by law enforcement and determined to be illegal. You can see here medicinal products are photographed, body parts, and tiger bone wine, which are all popular items in the illegal tiger trade. The global demand for such items is driving poaching, and poaching remains a primary threat to the survival of wild tigers. Since the 1500s, the distribution of wild tigers has declined by 95%. And now a majority of the global population in the thousands survives in India, with the second largest population of wild tigers in Russia. Now, interestingly, while wild tigers remain endangered in the wild, there are over 12,000 tigers in captivity around the world. For example, in the United States itself, it's estimated that there are more captive tigers than the number of wild tigers living in India. And they are so poorly regulated in the United States that we don't really have a true count on how many tigers there are, but it's estimated that the United States alone has 5,000 to 10,000 captive tigers. Now, there are generally two settings in which a captive tiger is found and bred. One is a accredited zoo institution, which where tigers are bred for research and education, where breeding is very scientifically managed. However, the other setting, which is where a majority of the world's captive tiger population is in a commercial setting. It's where it's tiger farms, if you've heard of these. These are places that are breeding tigers at commercial scales for both entertainment and for the trade in their parts. And these are places like in the US where there's not tiger farms necessarily, there's not breeding at such a large scale that's happening like in Asia, but there is breeding again for tourists, primarily for the purpose of tourists coming and paying to either pet cubs or take photos with them. And what's interesting about, you know, just captive tigers in general is that there are international regulations in place that prohibits breeding tigers in captivity for the trade in their parts. However, really, since tigers have been bred in captivity, their parts have been found in the illegal trade. So there is a lot of leakage happening in terms of this, the legal captive breeding of tigers leaking into the illegal trade. So that's why sort of the knowing about captive tigers is important, because it is another source of tigers along with the wild populations. So my research, it examined law enforcement records within the United States of tiger parts seized from 2003 to 2012. The most surprising finding is highlighted here in a Manga Bay article that highlighted our research. And it was really the scale of crime that had occurred in the United States. What we found was 292 seizure incidents that had happened, and this was significantly higher than any other previously reports had documented. And so just knowing that the scale of crime in the United States was so much higher than we had previously known was simply shocking. Now, most of the tiger parts that entered the United States were medicinal products, and claws and teeth were also popular items. U.S. law enforcement seized these tiger parts, mainly entering the country in San Francisco, and Dallas and Atlanta were also popular entry hotspots. Most illegal tiger parts entered the US from China, but popular export countries also included Vietnam, Canada, and Thailand. Now, Canada might come out as a little surprise, but in terms of just trade dynamics in general, Canada is just geographically really close to the United States. So just in terms of wildlife in general, we do find that a lot of illegal items enter the US from Canada or Mexico, just places that are close. Although, you know, of course, they don't likely originate from there. One of the most curious things about our research was that it was largely inconclusive about the ultimate source or country of origin of seized items in the trade. So more than I've highlighted here that more than half of the items were of an unknown country of origin, and very few items were documented to originate from countries like India or Russia, where a majority of the wild tiger populations live. On the other hand, we see that China, Vietnam, and Thailand, which are tiger farming countries, are major countries of exports for illegal tiger parts entering the United States. So although a third of tiger parts were of an unknown source, we found that almost all the parts with a known source came from a wild tiger. And I know we'll talk more a little bit more about that. Now, what's really the burning question here is, you know, okay, 99.5% of seized tiger parts with a known source came from a wild tiger. So where were these tigers poached? I think that really is the ultimate question for me when diving into the illegal trade in tigers. Because ultimately, the goal in all of this research is to address tiger poaching and reduce the poaching of wild tigers. So finding out where those tigers were poached would provide really good intel for anti-poaching efforts on the ground. But in order to answer this question, we need to use other methods, such as forensic DNA analysis. So our research and a lot of what we know about tiger trafficking currently comes from law enforcement records, but these are missing a lot of important pieces of information, and forensic methods can be used to identify the geographic origin and inform anti-poaching efforts. Investing in and developing forensic DNA methods was an important recommendation we had from this research. And with that, I'm gonna just wrap up this sort of summary, and then we can have a little conversation about our
results. Thanks, Sarika. It's very fascinating findings, especially because particularly here in India, when we think of illegal trade in wildlife and even in tigers, we think of China and Southeast Asia as demand countries, but the US doesn't immediately come to mind. And your research now shows that this is a concern. And, you know, bridging these knowledge gaps will help us find solutions. But I'm curious about, you know, it sometimes feels like you're just scratching the surface of what we know about the trade. And I'm curious about what you think are other knowledge gaps that need to be bridged before we can really find a solution?
Yeah, well, I think first off, it's really important to highlight that all of my findings, it comes from data from 2003 to 2012. And this is data that's almost a decade old. Illegal trade, these transnational organizations, they're really smart and adaptive. And so trade is just, it's constantly changing. So we know that the patterns that I found, you know, in the last decade are not reflective of current patterns, but they still are important to sort of lead questions that we're asking now. So I just want to say that just in general. I think the knowledge gap remains still about the current US demand, sort of like you said. I mean, even knowing that, wow, the US had that much demand even back then and we didn't know it, it sort of just blows the whole lid off of like, what else don't we know? And like you said, I just think that there's too much we don't know. The fact is that I do think that Asia remains the main driver of demand for tiger parts specifically. But, you know, my findings, it's a second step. There's been a lot of research finding, like, one of the routes that's really popular for wild tigers that are sourced from India. It goes from India through Nepal to China on the ground. And that's sort of like the route that we had mapped out. But from my research, we're also finding there's other routes that originate from China to other countries. So they're acting sort of as an international distributor of illegal products. And I think that's a huge, huge red flag. And there just needs to be even more attention sort of given to that. And sort of a second sort of knowledge gap I'd like to highlight is that most products that were seized in the United States were medicinal products. And we don't really know detailed information about where these products are being manufactured. And we see this pattern where it's unprocessed tiger parts, such as skin and bones, are the most commonly seized item in Asia. So in India and in Nepal and China, unprocessed parts are the most popularly seized items. But internationally in the European Union and the United States, it's these medicinal products that are the most commonly seized item. One, there's bias in law enforcement. So of course you have to take that into consideration, but it definitely points to some questions about like, where are these medicinal products being processed at commercial scales? This isn't something that's happening without important people knowing. You know, I think like any illegal activity, corruption is a huge thing that enables tiger trafficking to continue. And then in general, our study, as well as many others on the illegal wildlife trade, have depended so heavily on law enforcement data, but we really need to sort of combine that knowledge with other ways of knowing, you know, going undercover and using forensics.
Right. So there's a lot more work that needs to go in for us to really know where to focus our efforts. Particularly for law enforcement. You spoke briefly of the importance of forensics, Sarika, and you said it might help us better focus our anti-poaching efforts if we knew where these wild tiger parts are coming in from. You know, in the Indian context, forensics plays an incredibly important role, particularly as evidence when prosecuting the perpetrators of wildlife crime. So I was curious if you could, you know, it would be great if you can actually walk us through applications of forensics and conservation and how they can really change the game for tiger conservation.
Yeah, well, you know, from my research, we really were inconclusive about like the ultimate source and our country of origin of a lot of these products. But again, if we want to protect the wild tigers that are under threat, we need this information. So that's where really where forensics comes into play is, you know, I imagine now the technology and the collaborations that are necessary in order to actually see this to fruition, I think is several years away. But, you know, let me walk you through like my dream scenario of like what forensics would look like in tiger trafficking. It would be sort of, you know, law enforcement seizes, let's say US law enforcement seizes an item entering the United States. They take a DNA sample from that medicinal product. And by the way, it's really hard to get DNA from medicinal products, but let's say the technology is there. We get a tiger DNA sample from this product. Then we also have DNA databases of the wild tiger populations in all of the tiger range countries like India, Russia, Thailand. And then we also have a DNA database of all the captive tigers too. The captive tigers in the United States, the captive tigers in the tiger farms in China and Vietnam. We run this sample. It's sort of like how forensics works with the, you know, the thumbprint for people in those DNA databases. I'm very oversimplifying it here, but basically you match the DNA that was on the seized item to the database of wild tigers and captive tigers, and you find a match. If it is from a wild tiger, you know, the sort of technology has gone to the point where you really can pinpoint the region from where it came from. So we can get a general idea of like what sort of tiger subpopulation it came from. Like I could probably say, oh, it came from, you know, northern Maharashtra around some tiger that, you know, moves between Kanha and Pench, so to say, around that general area. That's like pretty specific when it comes to law enforcement knowing that, knowing, oh, there was a poaching incident there. If it wasn't on their radar, if it hadn't been on their radar before, now they know, like, oh, a poaching incident happened and we didn't even know about it, right? So that should sort of kick into affect strategies on their end in terms of let's do more to detect these poaching events, et cetera. So there's that. And then in terms of if that item happens to be from captivity, well, that all is related to international regulations, which prohibit the trade in captive parts. But all of that information, like you said, can be used as evidence in criminal cases, which ultimately is very important because wildlife crime, as compared to other crimes, is low risk and high reward. So seeing through convictions and having consequences for people who are doing this is important to deter people.
Absolutely. In India, we have, you know, the tiger census data that identifies tigers by stripes. And often, you know, when there is a poaching incident and a skin is seized, you can pinpoint which park or which area that tiger came from. And that's hugely useful, right, in redirecting efforts to anti-poaching efforts in particular. So I'd imagine at an international scale, this can really double up efforts and make a large impact. So that's quite the dream scenario you have there, though.
I mean, you laid it out. It's exactly like skin. It happens that, you know, it's unfortunate, but, you know, the trade in tiger parts involves parts that you can't really match like that. So forensics it's really the same thing. We can just do it with more parts and in more diverse settings.
Right. You know, it's fascinating how research can drive change in policy and in law. And I think I would imagine that's extremely rewarding. And one of the recommendations that you make in your paper is for the US to pass the Big Cat Public Safety Act. How do you think that the passage of this law will help? And can you just give us like a simplified version of what this law does?
Yeah, well, I would say, I mean, I think in general, working on sort of this policy-oriented research, it definitely is fulfilling, but it also is, it's complicated, as you'll see in a minute. So the Big Cat Public Safety Act, it's important because it's a step towards the United States fulfilling its obligations to ensure that we are not trading in captive bred parts. Because the United States does not have a federal law to even count or track tigers. And, you know, most sort of concerning to me is there's no law that sort of oversees or manages the disposal of tiger parts. And given that a majority of the captive tigers in the United States are in backyards, they're held by private owners, the disposal of their high value parts is very important. So there are no laws in the US. It's really Wild West out here in terms of captive tigers as of right now. So the Big Cat Act is important because basically it outlaws pet tiger ownership. And that's important because of, you know, for public safety reasons. I mean, a lot of people who are private owners of tigers, they don't really know exactly how much goes into owning a tiger. And there have been incidences of tigers escaping and posing a public safety hazard. So the pet tigers, so the Big Cat Act, the big thing is that it prohibits that. And that just sort of helps reduce the overall like number and overall amount of captive tigers that will be in the United States. But in my perspective, it still doesn't really do enough when it comes to, again, upholding and ensuring the United States really is compliant to international regulations. So it's a step, but it's certainly not enough. So I would say, in the sense of like doing research that is policy oriented, it is fulfilling because I see the Big Cat Public Safety Act already in Congress, already having made strides, and my research can be sort of a small push towards that. But it can also be challenging and maybe frustrating because I know it's not enough and I would like to see a lot more.
Yeah, that sounds like a complicated situation, and I really hope this law falls through. Sorry, it doesn't, goes through. I'm so sorry. I really hope it doesn't fall through.
I think captive tigers in general, you know, I mean, it's just such a lot. It's not very widely known. It's not widely known that they're, there are more captive tigers in the world than there are wild tigers. And at a time when, you know, in terms of conservation, we're talking about conserving wild tigers, it just really makes you reflect on like, how did we get here? Like, what created this kind of mad situation where there's wild and captive sources that we're trading internationally in all of them, yet at the same time we're all telling each other we're trying to save tigers. It's super complicated.
I also wonder, Sarika, especially since COVID happened and the world literally was brought down to its knees, and it's suspected to be a zoonotic disease. How does having a tiger in your backyard play into that? And does that help drive policy?
Wow, interesting. I don't know of any direct links of specifically like the trade in tiger parts linked to zoonotic disease. I think in general, we know that, you know, wildlife trade does pose that risk. So I don't think there's any direct links specifically with tigers and zoonotic disease sort of spilling over to humans and causing another pandemic. But there certainly just is risk to the captive tiger themselves in terms of just like welfare of that animal. Again, people, private owners, a pet tiger takes so much to care for. They cost thousands of dollars just to feed, and they need veterinary care. They're not animals that are meant to be roaming in a 6 by 6 foot cage in a backyard. They have huge territories. I think when it comes to pet tigers and disease, I more think of the impact on the animal itself.
Thanks for that, Sarika. It's also really interesting that one of the findings from your paper that 99.5% of tiger parts from a known source were from a wild tiger is truly a staggering statistic. And so, you know, that leads me to ask about what is your hypothesis about how India's wild tigers fit into the larger puzzle of, you know, trade in tigers?
Yeah, well, that's a complicated question because my data doesn't say anything really conclusive about it. But the fact is that India has been and remains the country with the largest supply of wild tigers. And as long as there is a demand for tiger parts, India's wild tigers will be threatened. And I simply worry about India's wild tigers because in a sort of funny way, India has been so successful at conserving its tigers. So, you know, we have government census showing a growing tiger population. So the success, you know, we are maintaining and creating that supply for wild tigers. So again, as long as that demand exists, I just think, you know, we can't shut our eyes. We can never back down from the threat of poaching. But I can't answer your question in terms of India's specific connection, just because we just don't have the data. But just simply knowing where wild tigers are, You know, it's surprising that my study was inconclusive about things, but again, it just goes to show that there's a lot more work to do.
Yeah, and hopefully what you recommended about more forensic analysis will give us a better sense of how what things are like in India and how it fits into the global trade. I hope that, you know, works out in the future, in the foreseeable future, because it's an urgent need to conserve tigers. So
yeah. One thing I actually wanted to add about India's wild tigers too is, you know, the international demand for tiger parts is not the only thing driving poaching in India. There is a ton of human wildlife conflict. We know tigers kill people, you know, pose threats to livelihoods. They are killed in retaliation. They can also be killed sort of as what I call bycatch. You know, they're caught on a snare that was actually meant for an herbivore. And so not all poaching is driven by the demand, this international demand. And so I think something, an interesting question to ask in India on the ground is like what ultimately is the main driver of poaching in these critical spots for tigers. Now, interestingly, I don't know of any specific work in central India that has sort of emerged lately on that topic. But one of my colleagues who works on tiger trafficking in Russia, again, the country with the second largest wild tiger population, she found that the demand for medicinal products in China was the main driver of poaching. You know, so just again, this all sort of comes down to how data can inform the conservation actions and sort of the feedbacks between those two fields.
Thanks for that, Sarika. That is food for thought. You know, much of the folks in our audience are engineers in the making. And there is this misconception that you need to be a biologist and you need to be, you know, in your field clothes and in the forest to really make a difference. But that's not necessarily true. And so I was wondering if you wanted to throw some light on how you can contribute no matter what walk of life you come from.
Yeah, well, I think it's actually funny because, you know, at the beginning I talked about sort of what got you into conservation. I talked about field ecology and being outside is what got me in. I think that's what draws a lot of people to ecology. But to be honest, most of my time is spent at a desk behind a computer screen, just like the rest of you, right? So that's the reality of it. And I'm sharing that because everybody has a huge role to play in conservation. And actually for me, I see engineers, you know, I think multiple times a week, I wish I had an engineering background to help just think about problems differently. And be able to, you know, maybe do some more coding and computer science. Because, you know, big data is, you know, driving a lot of things, and to analyze all of that, you really have to, you know, an engineering background, big data, and just thinking about problems, not even necessarily in a natural world setting. That's just the type of people we need. I think we are really, without sounding, you know, sort of like those scientists from Don't Look Up. I don't know if you've seen that. That Netflix show. If you haven't, I highly recommend it. But I'm trying not to sound arm wavy, but I think we forget that we are in a extinction crisis. You know, like this is crisis mode. We need everybody on deck. So kind of like specific things that I see for engineers. One of the a project that I'm involved in with that I didn't really talk about is a project that uses sound to answer questions about biodiversity. So what we do, this project is called Project Dwani, and we put recorders in the forest and just record all the sounds. So we record all the vocalizing biodiversity. You know, if there's a road nearby, you record the road noise, you just record everything. That has a ton of engineering applications. Like one of the things that we're trying to do is develop an algorithm to automatically identify specific species within these recordings. And so we're working with engineers to develop that algorithm, right? I could never do that. I really, as a biologist, I just don't have the background. But what I do have the background in is understanding more of the ecology of that species. So I think there's just a ton of room for collaborations and just getting curious. And so, you know, I guess like my piece of advice would just be if this work interests you at all, reach out to people, you know, people working in conservation. We're all in this together. So if you need advice, if you just want to talk to somebody and ask questions, I think a lot of us are willing and able to do that.
Absolutely. And it's not just like engineers are of course huge potential to contribute. It's also journalists and lawyers and illustrators, and no matter what background you come from, you have a vital role to play.
So true. Yeah. I mean, so yeah, just to go off of that, even for me to understand like a lot of the policy implications of my work and to truly like grasp these things, I was talking to a lot of lawyers, you know, and getting their feedback and stuff. So yeah, everybody has a role to play.
Awesome, Sarika. Last question for you is, you know, you open the newspaper, you read about how Amazon rainforests are burning, you read about tigers being poisoned, you read about loss of habitat, you read about construction projects through protected areas. It doesn't look very good when you're just going through the news. And so it's hard to be hopeful during times like these. So I'm curious about what keeps you going and you know, is that something we can all learn from?
I hope so. For me, it's the community of people actually who care about the planet and who are doing something to help. It's just the people that keep me going, really. And mainly actually everybody. So like when we met, you know, I was immediately energized by, I think both of us, you energize each other with shared passions for wildlife. But then also I think the people who most inspire me are frontline workers in conservation. And those are like the forest guards and the people who are like 24/7 on the ground in these places where we are doing conservation. Gosh, these people are the most courageous. You know, they're giving up the most in terms of time away from their family to be in these remote places. Just their dedication to their work and listening to their stories is really what ultimately motivates me.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. That resonates so well with me as well. Thank you so much, Sarika, for your time and for walking us through your research, which is fascinating. And I hope that we all have takeaways and are motivated to do something about conservation in our individual capacities. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me, and please don't hesitate to reach out.
It was indeed an engaging session. I'd like to thank Sarika Kanwalkar ma'am and Advocate Mridula Vijayaraghavan ma'am for their insightful discussion, for sharing their extensive knowledge and expertise, and for contributing to the SGR Knowledge Foundation's knowledge series. I'd like to express my gratitude to Mr. Sonil Raisoni, Chairman of the Raisoni Group of Institutions, for offering this opportunity. Thank you to everyone who joined the session.
Sony Group, a vision beyond.